Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Mazzelli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health policy, health innovation, and technology, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Lewis Wade Sullivan, founding dean and president emeritus at the Morehouse College of Medicine, the first predominantly black College of Medicine in the 20th century. He also served as Health and Human Services Secretary under the first Bush administration, dedicating his life's work to promoting equity in the health professions and equity and access to health care for all Americans. Lori Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of factcheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. Or you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or ask Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with former HHS Secretary Dr. Lewis Wade Sullivan on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with the Honorable Dr. Lewis Wade Sullivan, founding dean and president emeritus at the Morehouse School of Medicine, the first predominantly black medical school in the 20th century. He's the former secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services under President George H.W. Bush and is chairman of the Sullivan Alliance, which seeks to increase diversity in the healthcare workforce. He's authored many publications and several books, including his 2014 autobiography, Breaking Ground, My Life in Medicine, which won the NAACP Image Award. He's received numerous honors, including being inducted this year into Modern Healthcare's Hall of Fame. He earned his medical degree from Boston University School of Medicine and completed his residency in hematology at Cornell Medical Center in New York. Dr. Sullivan, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, my pleasure to join you.
Yeah, you know, we are honored to have you here, a renowned physician, educator, civil rights pioneer, and you've made your life mission to foster health equity in this country and really around the globe. What an incredible story from a childhood in a segregated South to your time as the only student of color in your medical class in the 1950s to the founding of Morehouse School of Medicine to serving as Secretary of HHS in the first Bush administration. And you charted this incredible course to service that mission. And as you look back on the collective body of your work in healthcare, health policy, health equity, what do you view as some of your greatest achievements?
Well, I've had the great opportunity to be involved in a number of areas. I've gotten great satisfaction from them. But I would say the most significant achievement, I think, is serving as a founding dean and initial president of Morehouse School of Medicine, because that school was founded because of the severe shortage of African-American physicians, as well as other minority physicians. So I view that institution as one which hopefully will be around for 200-300 years or more to really address that. So that's perhaps would be the one. The second, obviously, would be having served as U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services, but have had many opportunities for service during my life, and I'm pleased to have had those opportunities.
Well, Dr. Sullivan, I want to say just before I launch into my question that I had the pleasure of reading your autobiography, and I think I would put up there on the list of good fortune or opportunity. It sounds like you had amazing parents who were so instilling of values and purpose in life. So,
well, I agree. I was very fortunate, and my older brother Walter as well, that my parents were very dedicated to us getting as strong an education as they could provide us.
Yep.
Because in rural Georgia, during the years of segregation, the schools for blacks were very inferior in terms of books, lack of instruments. There was no band at the black high school where there was at the white high school, and other things. So that's why my parents, when I was in fifth grade, my brother in sixth grade, sent us away to live with relatives in Savannah for a year, and the following year took us to Atlanta to attend school there, so we would get a much better education.
Well, we're grateful to them. And, you know, Dr. Sullivan, I can't help but think as we review your work and your life of the quote from Dr. Martin Luther King, who said that of all the forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane. And you've said that while there were flaws for sure in the health law, the Affordable Care Act, it did so much to address that fundamental concept of injustice in health care that Dr. King spoke of. Certainly, over these years, the health law has suffered challenges and setbacks and attacks, but it's still standing. Maybe you could share with us and our listeners your vision for how you hope to see the country now move forward on health reform.
Oh, yes. No, I'm very committed to improving access to health care because, from my perspective, the two most important things that we can provide our young people and really more broadly to provide our country are healthy, well-educated citizens. So it means investing in education and in health. Not only is a humane perspective, but also an economic perspective. We want to have citizens who are healthy so they can be independent, can work, provide income for themselves and their communities, take care of the community. So I see investing in health and in education as an investment not only in these citizens, but more broadly, investing in the manpower that we need as a country 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 mm-hmm. years from now. So I see this as very clear, and I have always been mystified by the fact that we spend as a nation tremendous energies and times arguing about whether we should provide health care or not. Mm-hmm. There shouldn't be any argument there because the data show that if you provide things such as vaccines for children, good nutrition, medical checkups, give people information they need to protect their health, such as not smoking, mm-hmm. Not abusing alcohol, and certainly avoiding drugs, exercising, etc. All of these things really lead to a healthier individual and therefore a more productive citizen. So I am very strong in my position that we as a country should have better access to health for everyone. And I say the government does have a role. The private sector has a role. Individuals have a role. We should really all be working together rather than finding reasons not to invest in our health system, because it simply makes good sense, as well as a good humanitarian argument, to have healthy citizens who are more productive and who can contribute to the welfare of everyone.
Well, Dr. Sullivan, you met some struggles and resistance as the HHS Secretary under President Bush in your quest to launch health reforms that would address the reality for tens of millions of uninsured Americans. But you were able to take some significant steps to address health disparities, as well as initiate measures aimed at moving the whole country towards better health. And I wonder if you could talk to our listeners about the Healthy People Initiative, as well as the other significant health policies that you were able to launch at that time.
We released Healthy People 2000 in September of 1990. This was an outline for the things that individuals and families can do to protect and enhance their health. Vaccines are a tremendous development, and we have eliminated smallpox from the world. Mm-hmm. We have diminished greatly other communicable diseases such as polio, which is close to being eliminated from the world. Things such as measles, diphtheria, mumps, and other childhood communicable diseases. While a number of children who get these diseases really will pass through a phase and recover, unfortunately, there are complications that do occur mm-hmm. in some children. Deafness, meningitis, even death can occur. So vaccines for children given at the appropriate time will have a major impact in protecting the health of that individual. We know that we should avoid tobacco use. We also have very solid evidence that having an active lifestyle, exercising, mm-hmm. really leads to a better health, longer life. Some evidence suggests that the likelihood of developing Alzheimer's is less if you're active, et cetera. So the Healthy People 2000 initiative was launched to inform the public about those things that they can do and should do to protect their health. In 1990, this was considered really soft science, but mm-hmm. There's no question about the data and its importance. The other thing that we did was to work to increase the diversity, racial and ethnic and gender diversity in the department, because I often say that the health professions are science-based professions, but they are delivered in a social setting. Mm-hmm. So you need to have the well-trained, knowledgeable scientist, but that person also should know how to relate to that individual who has come seeking help or information. Because when you're talking about health issues, these are very sensitive issues for so many people. And if you really don't demonstrate that you are an individual who has empathy, who can be trusted with sensitive information, then you won't get that information mm-hmm. from the patient. Therefore, you will be hampered in your ability to respond. So the cultural competence of the individual is important. So we were able to appoint the first female director of the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Mm-hmm. Bernadine Healy.
Yep.
We formed a women's health research program at NIH that has been tremendous. We were able to appoint the first minority and first female surgeon general, Dr. Antonio Novello, the first black Social Security commissioner we had appointed,
mm-hmm.
the first administrator for the Healthcare Financing Administration, which is now the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The reason that was important, to have people who have had different life experiences bring their experience so that we can learn how to interact with our general public and provide the services that the public needs. So the other thing, we created the Office for Research in Minority Health at National Institutes of Health. That now has become the National Institute for Minority Health mm-hmm. and Health Disparities. So people really with their cultural differences, their language, their histories, et cetera, they must see themselves represented in the health system if mm-hmm. they are to trust it and to utilize it effectively. So that's why we need to have more racial and ethnic and gender diversity in the health professions.
Well, Dr. Sullivan, what a track record of making sure that these highly qualified people were in positions of leadership and really influenced change. But you also were just wrapping up there talking about increasing the diversity in the health profession workforce. I wonder if you could comment, how well have we done with that? What's your sense of how we're doing?
Well, we've made some progress, but the amount of progress has been far less than what we had expected. For example, in 1950, 2% of America's physicians were African American, when African Americans represented about 10% of the population. Today, 5% of the physicians in America are African American, whereas we now represent 12% of the population. 17% of our population today is Hispanic, and our Hispanic physicians are only approximately 6%. So we have made some progress, but far from what is needed. So that's why we, all of us, must still work to see that we have much more diversity in our health profession. All of us, as Americans, really need to see that we have healthy citizens, well-educated citizens. That will lead to us continuing to be leading the world mm-hmm. in terms of innovation, scientific discovery, a strong economy. So that's why everyone should be interested in this and has a stake in seeing that we reach those goals.
We're speaking today with the Honorable Dr. Lewis Wade Sullivan, founding dean and president emeritus at the Morehouse School of Medicine. He's former secretary of HHS under President George H.W. Bush and is chairman of the Sullivan Alliance, which seeks to increase diversity in healthcare workforce. Dr. Sullivan, with your many achievements, you've shown no sign of slowing down. And in 2005, you launched the Sullivan Alliance to transform the health professions. And we've talked a little bit about this, which seeks to not only promote health careers for people of color, but also to educate minority populations to be aware of the undue health risks they face. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the mission at the Sullivan Alliance and how you're reaching into the most vulnerable communities to make a difference.
First of all, having health as a goal means having not only health professionals and having facilities for treating people, but also means having an educated citizenry on health issues. So the individual citizens play a very important role in helping to maintain their health. So the Sullivan Alliance came about as a result of an initiative from the Kellogg Foundation, which formed a committee that's called the Sullivan Commission to look at ways to increase diversity in the health professions. After 2 years, we issued a report titled Missing Persons, minorities in the health professions. And it pointed out the things I've already alluded to, the relative shortage of minorities in the health professions. After that report was released, we were then funded to form what we call the Sullivan Alliance, as well as members of another body that had a similar report released by the Institute of Medicine, headed by Dr. Lonnie Bristow, who was the first African-American president of the American Medical Association. The Sullivan Alliance in 2005, when it began, had as its mission to implement the many recommendations coming from the Sullivan Commission, as well as from the Institute of Medicine Committee, things such as changing the educational environment in health profession schools to be more cooperative, less competitive, having commitment from the leaders of these institutions to have a diverse student body and faculty. Thirdly, having adequate financial resources so that students would not have to go into tremendous debt. And we've done very poorly on that as a nation. I think one of the problems we have created, we have made it more difficult from a financial perspective for a young person to become a health professional. Those who do make it through end up with debts of $200,000, $300,000, with these young professionals then having to repay student loans, which interferes with their ability to buy a home or to establish a practice. So the Sullivan Alliance has worked to really try and address the need for sufficient financial resources, because today things are very different from the mid-50s when I went to medical school. Financial aid was available, and students of my generation really did not graduate with such burdensome debt as our students are doing today. So the Alliance has worked to form alliances within states around the country when we found the leadership to do that. So we're operating in Ohio, in Florida, in North Carolina, Virginia, Nebraska. We develop alliances between academic health centers and colleges that have significant numbers of minority students to develop programs that involve counseling young people about the path to become a health professional, mentoring them, answering their questions, financial planning, as well as academic courses, etc. So that is an ongoing effort, because health is so essential to having a strong nation. I always say there's no such thing as a wealthy nation that has an unhealthy population. And there are many examples around the world of countries that have a very heavy burden of disease and injury, and those countries are poor because their citizens are impaired in their ability to contribute to the overall economy. So that's why having a healthy population and an educated population, I see as a national priority that's in the interest not only of the individuals who benefit from that, but our larger society that benefits from that directly in so many ways. So that's what the purpose of the Sullivan Alliance is.
Well, that's wonderful, and thank you for sharing that with us. Dr. Sullivan, you worked shoulder to shoulder and alongside some of the leading civil rights activists in the United States, like Martin Luther King, like Andrew Young and others. But I know you also collaborated with global leaders such as the late South African President Nelson Mandela, who fought so hard against injustice in his country. What did you learn from your work with President Mandela and other global health warriors over the years? And are there bright spots that you look at around the globe in the advancement of the cause of health equity?
I've learned a lot and benefited a lot from the people I have met and interacted with, President Mandela, Martin Luther King Jr., Andy Young, and others. But my work with President Mandela was part of an effort to increase the number of black health professionals in South Africa. There was an organization that was formed called Medical Education for South African Blacks, formed in 1983 by Herbert and Joy Kaiser. Herb Kaiser had been a career member of the U.S. Foreign Service and had served in South Africa, and he saw the condition there for blacks. At the time, there were only 200 black doctors in South Africa with a black population of some 43 or 44 million. So when he retired, he formed this organization. I was invited and later became chairman of the organization. Our purpose was to raise funds for scholarship support for Black students attending medical, nursing, dental, and other health profession schools in South Africa. Because at the time, the apartheid regime was being dismantled, and Blacks were being admitted to the universities for the first time. But no financial aid was a part of the process. And absence of financial aid meant they really did not have the resources to attend the university. So with a board made up of Americans and South Africans, worked to raise funds for scholarships for these students. And from 1983 until 2008, the organization supported more than 10,000 students who became doctors, nurses, dentists, veterinarians, and other health professionals in South Africa. So Nelson Mandela was one of our advisors, and we would have a dinner in New York annually to honor an American and South African who had helped the effort. And so Mandela was one of our honorees 1 year, but he could not attend because the year we honored him, he was negotiating a peace arrangement between Rwanda and Burundi. But Mandela was a great leader for South Africa and an example for all of us around the world, because having suffered under apartheid, his goal of redemption and a peaceful, stable, orderly society really has meant all of the difference in South Africa between a possible Holocaust they could have had, had indeed there been retribution after the rollback of apartheid. And South Africa has been the beneficiary of that, as well as other countries around the world. So working with him has been a great example for me. One other thing I would mention pertaining to South Africa is we've had one student from South Africa who attended Morehouse School of Medicine. He graduated in 1991. He had had to flee South Africa in 1976 because he was head of a student uprising protesting against apartheid. But he came to America, attended Morehouse College, my alma mater, and Dr. King's alma mater, Martin Luther King Jr. He entered our medical school at Morehouse and graduated in 91, trained as a surgeon in Tampa, Florida, then went back to South Africa. But he then learned, coming back to America afterwards, the blood banking system, because he then went back to South Africa and founded the first nationwide blood banking system for South Africa, which was launched in 2009. That was important because one of the problems in South Africa and many places, including America, is HIV, the AIDS virus. Some 8 to 10% of the population was carriers of that virus. By establishing the blood banking system, he was able to make the blood supply safe for South Africa. So that was a major achievement, and we consider that a significant contribution from the Morehouse School of Medicine to South Africa that really makes a difference in the lives and the safety of the blood supply in South Africa. And so those are the kinds of things that give me great personal satisfaction that we've been able to contribute to.
It's been our pleasure today to be speaking with the Honorable Dr. Lewis Wade Sullivan, founding dean and president emeritus at the Morehouse School of Medicine, former Secretary of Health and Human Services under President George H.W. Bush, and chairman of the Sullivan Alliance. You can learn more about his body of his work and his mission by going to thesullivanalliance.org or follow them on Twitter at Sullivan Alliance. Dr. Sullivan, thank you for your remarkable contributions to health education, health equity, your great leadership, and your role model to millions. We appreciate you joining us today at Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, thank you very much. It's my honor to spend this time with you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lurie, what have you got for us this week?
The Trump administration instituted new rules to expand association health plans and short-term limited-duration plans, which are expected to be less expensive options with fewer benefit requirements than plans sold on the Affordable Care Act's marketplaces, such as healthcare.gov. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has released a new report on the impact of such plans. The CBO estimated that 5 million additional people would enroll in association or short-term plans each year over the next 10 years because of the new rules. Most would be those who would have purchased plans in the small group or individual market, but about 1 million would be newly insured. The rules would cause premiums for the small group and individual markets to go up by about 3%. The federal rule for association plans, which are created by a group of employers, such as those in a similar industry, started applying to such insurance products on September 1st. The rule made it easier for such plans to be created. Insurance plans offered by associations couldn't deny coverage or charge more based on health status, but they wouldn't have to cover the 10 essential health benefits the ACA requires of plans on the small group market or individual market. Also, association plans could price plans based on age, gender, or occupation. Under the ACA, plans are limited to varying pricing based on age, family size, tobacco use, and geographic area. The short-term plans don't have to meet ACA requirements, including those essential health benefits, premium pricing restrictions, and prohibitions against denying or pricing coverage based on health status. They were limited to a duration of less than 3 months under an Obama-era rule that took effect in 2017. Trump administration rule allows insurers to extend plans for up to 3 years. The CBO report said the new association and short-term plans would be less expensive on average than small group and individual market plans, since the new plans don't have to meet many of the ACA requirements, and the plans are expected to attract those with low medical costs. The association plans can set premiums based on each individual association's expected medical spending, and therefore benefit by attracting groups with low-risk employees. For the short-term plans, they can exclude those with higher healthcare costs. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. As the saying goes, music soothes the savage beast. And according to a recent study conducted by Queen's University in Belfast, Ireland, there's some empirical data to back that up. In a first-of-a-kind longitudinal study, children suffering from a variety of behavioral and emotional conditions who were exposed to music therapy in addition to traditional therapies had far better outcomes than those children in a control group that offered traditional therapy without music therapy.
It's not a matter of them being given music or choosing music. They actually make music along with the music therapist assisting them. So the idea is for them to express themselves through music.
Lead researcher Dr. Sam Porter said there's been anecdotal evidence that music improves mood in children and adolescents as well as adults, but his study revealed just how effective the music therapy was.
An improvement in communication. There were two very interesting secondary outcomes, levels of depression and levels of self-esteem. And in the secondary outcomes, we find a statistically significant difference between the control group and the intervention group.
Dr. Porter says in the group given musical therapy, it showed over time more interaction with their surroundings and a better response to the traditional therapies as well. And he says the effects were sustained over time.
I mean, that's one of the marvelous things about music therapy, is the things that it's not. There are no side effects. It is not a dangerous therapy to get kids involved, and it is just such a good way and a harmless way of doing things.
The study was conducted in conjunction with the Northern Ireland Music Therapy Trust, which sees the promising findings as an incentive to incorporate this relatively low-cost, non-invasive therapy into standard protocols as an additional tool to enhance outcomes for the youth population, which often suffers negative side effects from powerful medications. A simple, targeted music therapy approach, age-appropriate and showing great efficacy in improving outcomes for young patients with minimal side effects and lasting benefits, now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.